live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, and I'd like to welcome you to this program. We have an empowering hour ahead of us, the latest on health and healing. What are figs good for? We'll let you know. They're trying to make it mandatory that everybody they say has to have a vaccine gets one in West Virginia. Are they practicing medicine without a license there? They're giving no exemptions? What happens when we take caffeine that could have a bad outcome? I'll give you the latest on that. Also, when children watch television, they develop some really serious long-term antisocial behaviors. Why is that? And why are we just now finding out about that? From our social issues, economic facts that'll make your head spin. So you believed all that nonsense the president was giving us and all the other talking heads in the bubble of Wall Street and the commodities market and the bubble in the bond market? If you believe any of that, shouldn't. I'll set the record straight and give you some reality of where we're really at. We, meaning about 90% of the American population. Information from Lynn Stewart, Paramore, Alternet. Then, for those of you who believe that it was really a big deal to have this wonderful rally on the mall in Washington this past Sunday to protest why the president should say no to the pipeline going from Canada to the Texas Gulf, was that a real protest or was it a pseudo-protest? And is this at all a serious climate issue that they're dealing with? David Swanson, I have my own thoughts and commentary. If time permits, what's happening with our rights? I'll hit you on several things today when it comes to fascism in America, including 14 defining characteristics of fascism. And this is from a newspaper, Madison Independent Examiner, Gregory Patton. And let's just see how close those are to what's happening in America today. And we are in a police state, and I'll give you examples of that, and some are really frightening. Let's begin. We have a lot to share. First up, in New York State, a call to action. There are hundreds of bills being introduced, and the language of one of those bills is really serious. Now, you have to understand that ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has been meeting with state legislators for 40 years in secret, telling them which bills, actually writing the bills, and then say, go back into this state, here are some co-sponsors, and pass this as law. These help the major corporations. They hurt the rest of the citizens, yet the citizens never knew about this. Most citizens never know of any law that's passed in the state and who was behind it, who wrote it, and what it means, until suddenly one day they find they're in violation of something they didn't know existed. Well, now, behind clearly the vaccine movement is ALEC and its pharmaceutical representatives. But this is the latest. This is Senate Bill 3650-2013, Actions. Let me repeat that. This is a public health law. It's S-3650-2013. I'll quote from, the committee shall evaluate the safety and efficacy of dietary supplements, and its duties shall include but not be limited to assessing available data and make specific recommendations to the commissioner regarding banning the sale of certain dietary supplements the committee deems harmful, establishing a public health education campaign on dietary supplements with variations specifically directed to target different groups. The member of the council shall receive, and then it goes on that they can authorize banning of anything they want. And they meet twice a year on this. So who would be this committee? Well, let me tell you exactly who would be on a committee. Pharmaceutical doctors, or those aligned with drugs are great, supplements are not. So this is how they're trying to get around the NAFTA. They're trying to get around the international treaty on banning codex alimentarius, banning vitamins. Do it at the state level. And how would they do it? Well, we've met in secret, of course, and we've determined, our experts, of course, that you shouldn't be taking these supplements, bad for you. And therefore, we're banning them, effective today. That's what this means. Now, we already know that New York State politics is a sewer, with nothing but sewer rats running around in it. I can't tell you the contempt I have for the political process in New York and New Jersey and California and some other places. But this is just one more way that these connivers are doing business. And if you doubt me, why don't you write your state legislator? And remember, we're heard all over the United States. We're in every state being broadcast right now. And ask them, have you ever attended a meeting with Alec? If so, how many meetings? Who did you meet with? What bills were you given? Did you sign as a co-sponsor those bills with Alec in their legislative sessions? This is a non-people's legislative session. And then did you take those bills back, and did you pass them? And how many of those bills that you were given, written by major corporate interest, did you pass into law in your state? And then you'll see how absolutely broad-based this cancer is. This is one more action. So I'm asking, at least today, because this is going to be in every state in America. They're using New York as a test. That's how they do it. Contact your state legislator and tell them, no, we do not need a public health law to tell us by the safety and efficacy of dietary supplements. There are federal laws under the FDA and U.S. Public Health Service that already cover that. This is just one more way for them to craft legislation to take away our rights. S3650-2013. Let's stop it now. This is from West Virginia. This is bill number 2306, titled, clarifying that the legislature is the sole authority regarding compulsory immunization. It's just been introduced this week, and I would hope that the people listening in West Virginia let them know that everything about this is wrong, that you should have the right, for religious reasons or philosophical reasons, not to have a child vaccinated. This gives offenses and penalties and makes it compulsory that every school-aged child is given vaccines. This is another Alec behind-the-scenes written piece of legislature where the pharmaceutical companies are happy that this is happening because they're going to make the money off the vaccines. If you ask them, can you show us the science that a child will be protected, any and every given child, there is no such science. It's all about greed and profit. And when a nation sleeps, this is how they work. So if you live in West Virginia, this is just one of those ones they're doing like they do in the dietary supplement. There are hundreds of these that Alec is moving forward, and they've got unlimited amounts of PR and cash and legislators to hire. This is from the University of Otago in New Zealand. It says, children and adolescents who watch a lot of television are more likely to manifest antisocial and criminal behavior when they become adults. And this was published in the U.S. Journal of Pediatrics. The study followed a group of 1,000 children and born from 1972 until they were 15. And then they saw how much television they watched, what they watched, and then how that impacted them. And a professor at the University Department of Preventive and Social Medicine and colleagues found that the risk of having a criminal conviction by early adulthood increased by about 30% with every hour that children spent watching TV on an average weeknight. Because then again, you ask, what do they watch? And then you see how much antisocial behavior, violence, alpha male behavior, breaking the rules. Quote, antisocial behavior is a major problem for society. While we're not saying that television causes all antisocial behavior, our findings do suggest that reducing TV viewing could go some way towards reducing rates of antisocial behavior in society. All right. Well, I believe that children should be exposed to very little television. I believe that what they should be exposed to is interacting with other children and nature. A novel herbal compound offers potential to prevent and treat Alzheimer's disease. Now, this is from Science Daily and published in Restorative Neurology and Neuroscience. And here's what it has to say. This was done at Capital Medical University in Beijing. They found that a chemical called TSG, derived from the Chinese herbal medicine Polygonum multiflorum, thumbed THUMNB, reversed both overexpression of a synuclein, a small protein found in the brain, and its accumulation using an Alzheimer's model. These results are important, so that means that we should be seeing more on this. Anything that can help with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's is plus, and this does, and it's natural, non-toxic. One more thing that Chinese medicine has done to help people with major conditions. Now, you've heard me mention Manuka honey. Manuka, M-A-N-U-K-A. It is one of the two most powerful healing honeys known. There's a lot of science behind it. This is the latest from the University of Technology in Sydney. Quote, Manuka honey is the most effective in healing wounds. Honey suppresses the growth of a quartet of bugs commonly infesting chronic wounds, but according to a finding, Manuka honey is the best of them for healing injuries. Now, researchers looked at three kinds of honey, Manuka, Kanuka, and clover, to determine which was the most effective in combating. And real Manuka honey comes from a plant that is native to New Zealand. And this was published in the Public Library of Science, one report. So, raw, unheated, really good. It inhibits bacterial growth. So that's what you want. A lot of people, including people with gangrene and people with bed sores, don't realize that if you mix colloidal silver with Manuka honey and aloe, you have a wonderful healing in poultice that you can put on. Stress, magnesium, and disease. According to Dr. Mark Cyrus, the U.S. Department of Agriculture says about 60% of adults in the U.S. do not consume the average amount of magnesium. What they don't tell us is that about 60% is based on minimum daily estimates set by the Department of Agriculture. They're very low. So actually, the number is much higher. In the best of times, magnesium takes from white processed food that most Americans eat, and it's minimal. I believe that 1,000 milligrams of magnesium a day is essential. They're saying about 300 to 400. I believe that's way under what we should be consuming. Now, why? Because when you're stressed, you have an increase in cortisol. That's a hormone. That causes magnesium to be dumped into the sweat in increasing quantities. Actually, there are all kinds of cellular stressors that drive down magnesium levels, including chemical stress. Radiation, chemicals, heavy metals put enormous stress on organs and tissues and cells. Magnesium mediates a good part of our body's ability to deal with and remove those heavy metals. Toxicities actually increase as magnesium levels fall. In plain language, that means that we have more allergic reactions. We come down with the flu more often and colds. So those are just some of the things, and we're more susceptible to disease, including of the heart, because magnesium is one of the single most important minerals for the heart and prevents stroke and cancer and neurological decline. So how much magnesium? I'm saying 1,000 milligrams. And even low magnesium is associated with an increase of depression. So you want to get your magnesium. I suggest getting it from magnesium citrate. That's the best. Now, the Indian neem, N-E-E-M tree, is a hope for cancer patients. This is from the Times of India. It was presented by Georgia Regents University Cancer Center. It says, neem, which has been used for centuries to treat inflammation and fever and malaria in India, could help kill cancer cells. Now, why? Because cancer cells typically avoid death by hijacking molecular chaperones that guide and protect the proteins that ensure normal cellular function, and then tricking them into helping mutated versions of the cell go forward. And the neem interferes in that process. Hence, it helps you. So, another novel and interesting way, and it's been around for a long time. It's certainly there to, as a part of Ayurvedic medicine. And according to Jonathan Benson of Natural News, preventative natural medicine could be curbing our spiraling medical cost. And here's how. Now, we all know that the prevailing healthcare medical model is overpriced. And for most people, it doesn't work. And there's virtually nothing in it that prevents disease. And a major consequence of this failed approach has been a rapid increase in healthcare costs over the years, so much so that the entire system is poised to collapse in on itself in the very near future if a new model is not soon adopted. Well, for those of us in the alternative field, the one that makes the most sense, logically speaking, is a preventative healthcare approach that focuses on boosting the body's own natural immune system through diet and lifestyle. And this strategy is not only far less expensive than trying to deal with sickness after it has already developed, but it also produces a much higher quality of life for those who adhere to it. But the question is, can this type of system actually work in real life? Well, I'll tell you, there's an awful lot of real-life people in this audience right now that it's worked for. Assuming that the pharmaceutical and vaccine and other sick care industries can lose their stranglehold on the medical system, a preventative healthcare model could work, and it could save society untold billions of dollars. Now, various local and state initiatives that promote preventative healthcare models already exist. In fact, they've been proving themselves to be the preferred method of providing affordable and equitable health care in this country. So we just have to get something going at the grassroots level, and I suggest starting a whole new movement nationwide of taking the best of what has happened in the past, the health support system, small groups of people working together. You might do it by disease, like diabetes support groups, or high blood pressure, or obesity support groups, or fatigue, whatever it is, and children's health support groups, and put the word out, and you can use the internet, and then bring people together, and then take articles from various sources and documentaries and information that are abundant. There are tens of thousands of articles out there, and pass them around and share them. And then start the gradual process of change and meet once every couple weeks and share your experiences with each other. You can do this easily. And then you create a larger support system because everyone knows someone who is sick. So even if we just started practicing more prevention, even a person, well, I'm not going to give up my this, that, and the other doctor, that's fine. But why don't you change your diet and change your exercise and change your stress? And those are the things that could work. And we have to do that at the grassroots level. I'm Gary Nall, and that's the latest on health and healing. I want to share some thoughts that I had after hearing from the talking heads, both corporate Democrats and Republicans, of how well we're doing. Maybe they're not out here in America where I'm traveling and filming, but most of the people I'm speaking with, including those who are, like myself, financially conservative, I don't believe in taking big gambles. I don't believe in buying stuff I cannot afford or would not be able to support and sustain a debt. And we just went through 20 years where people just went nuts because money was cheap, credit was for everyone, and everybody was looking the other way to see, were we qualified to buy and pay for what we had? Liar loans, but not just for houses, for everything. And so when people had it all come crashing down and realized that, gee whiz, their house was not really an ATM machine, then that just crushed the economy. Now remember, 70% of our economy is due to consumer spending. So if we don't have the money to spend, then only certain segments of society will continue to grow. Those that work through the subsidies like Medicare and Medicaid, those that work through the military-industrial complex, and those that are part of supporting people as they get poorer, which is really ironic. The worst off you get, the more money they make, including the private prison systems, etc. And then Wall Street, which is in a fantasy alchemist world of itself, its growth, its profits have nothing to do with the real economies that we live in. They have nothing to do with the little restaurant down the corner or the garage that, you know, is there to fix your truck. It has only to do with how to make money off derivatives and exotic instruments that none of us understand and that we're not in their field of play, but they make the profit off of it. So here's the reality of the real society we're economically we're living in. First, be realistic. Number one, the recovery is only for those who are wealthy. And for everyone else, it's recession time. According to Lynn Stewart Paramore, the economic recovery is in rather limited supply. Research by economist Emmanuel Saez shows that the top 1% was enjoying growth of 11% since the official end of the recession. The other 99% has actually declined. Number two, half of us are poor or barely scraping by. Now, how do we know that? The latest Census Bureau data shows that one in two Americans currently falls in either the low-income category or is living in poverty. Now, low income is defined as those earning between 100 to 199% of the poverty level. Now, adjusted for inflation, the earnings for the bottom 20% of families have dropped from $16,788 to just under $15,000. And it's supposed to drop even more. So states in the South and West had the highest proportion of low-income families: Arizona, New Mexico, and South Carolina. And by the way, those are also the states where their politicians are destroying the social safety nets that were meant to help people. We also have to look at the meal plans in America. 47 million Americans must now use food stamps in order to get a meal, and many aren't old enough to earn money for themselves. Half of all children in the United States will be on food stamps during some part of their childhood. And for black children, 90% of all black children in the United States will be on food stamps before they hit 18. 8% of those receiving food stamps are senior citizens. The average monthly SNAP benefit, that's food stamps, is $133.85. So for those who are glib about, oh, you know, we're giving all these people free food, friends at Fox, why don't you try $1.50 per meal? See how much you get for $1.50. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, a gallon of milk costs $3.50 on average in the U.S., while a pound of stew beef at cheap quality is $4.30. Those prices just keep increasing. It'd be nice if we were at a place where we understood the needs of society and took people to the country who volunteered and paid them and let them grow food for the poor. Everything they grew organically, non-GMO'd, millions of acres could be growing, and that food would go into the food shelters where people could go so no American would be hungry, and they would actually be eating healthy foods. Now, how easy would that be? First, you're able to get people who are unemployed employed at living wage. Then you're able to use land that would be in balance with nature by growing it organically. Then you would be able to get food to charities and churches and food centers so they wouldn't be scrambling. Have you ever been in these? I've been filming in them recently. And I was in one, and this sergeant major who was volunteering his time said, here's our food pantry. And we went in, and there was all the food was just garbage. And it was all old. And I said, you know, a lot of this stuff is dated. Do you really want to get a can? You know, it's this old, 4 years old? He said, well, that's all we get. You know, we really don't have a choice. I mean, if we see mold on something, we throw it away. But, you know, it's tricky. What if you had fresh, organic produce, and then you could dry and dehydrate that using natural techniques of fruits and vegetables? You could have so many things. You could have natural canneries in as part of the food development project. So people would have fresh, organic, canned and fresh and frozen stuff. Think of how much healthier people. Think of the obesity and diabetes, and think of heart disease you'd be preventing. Think of the people you put to work. Think of the people you'd be feeding. How easy would that be? Oh, I forgot. Monsanto wouldn't want that. The White House certainly wouldn't want that. Congress, no, they've been paid not to allow that. So just about everybody who has power would be against it. And then the people on Fox could complain about, you know, those lazy bums using our food stamps. Well, let me tell you something. I just want to see the people at Fox go for 1 month living in the shoes of the people who are the new poor and see how they feel and if their perceptions are changed at all. And that cold, callous thing they have in the middle of their heart called a stone, if it can actually feel any blood running through it that the average American has to experience. But there's another thing, these people who are indifferent, the neocons, old age and poverty. According to economist Kenneth Thomas, the U.S. has the dubious honor of having the highest elderly poverty rate of any industrialized nation, larger than Ireland. If poverty is measured as 50% of the median income, 25% of all elderly in America are now considered poor. 25%? We have tens of millions. Yes, that means we have tens of millions of poor seniors. Well, surely with that many people, someone would write an article, do a documentary, do a television special, do a broadcast. It'd be a part of the president's speech. Someone would do something. No, no one's doing anything. They're invisible. Aren't they invisible? We don't allow our kids to go near old people, do we? Unless it's grandma and grandpa. But outside of that, and only on holidays, not too close because the kids will say they smell strange, we have sliced and diced our society based upon age, race, ethnicity, culture, religion, education, economic standing. We all live in different departments, and we socialize and work with just people like us. It makes us feel too uncomfortable. So then who is out there advocating for them? Research shows that an increasing number of Americans are entering poverty in old age. The percentage of Americans 75 to 85 new to poverty doubled. Most elderly Americans living in poverty have serious medical problems, so they're sick, alone, and poor. Gee whiz, what could possibly go wrong with that scenario? Where's there a march on that? There is none. And there won't be. Incarceration nation? You bet. 2.5 million Americans are currently under lock and key, but that's not enough, is it? To really be good Americans, you know, good flag-waving Sean Hannity Americans, we need 20, 30 million Americans in prison because that would make the prison companies, you know, the free market arbiters of social issues, that would make them a lot happier, make a lot of people a lot happier. Because then you get mandatory vaccines, you get your meds, you get standardized, blanderized, adulterated food. Yeah, that's more than the population of Philadelphia, Houston, Texas, Phoenix, and Dallas combined. More than the entire state of New Mexico. The U.S. only has 5% of the world's population, but we have 25% of the world's prisoners. The cost of all these prisoners? $63.4 billion a year. $60,000 a prisoner. And the vast majority have never committed any violent crime. But these moralizing, self-righteous politicians, both Democrat and Republican, remember, this happened when the House, the Senate, and the White House was controlled by Democrats, too. But these are corporate Democrats. So that is some of the things we're thinking about. Oh, and if you thought it was going to be good for you because you can retire now, 53% of Americans feared they wouldn't have enough money to live comfortably in retirement. But it gets worse. Right now, the average person will spend $250,000 for medical expenses during their retirement. That's a bunch. You got that? You don't have it? Oh, you're counting upon Obamacare. Remember the great thing that the liberal Democrats all said was great? Well, I'll show you what kind of complete and total fraud the entire Obamacare is on an upcoming special Progressive Commentary Hour within the next 2 weeks. And of course, least of all, let us not forget the looting of America. American capitalism, as currently practiced, clearly redistributes income upward. And yet we keep hearing Bill O'Reilly say, these are these liberals who want to redistribute wealth. I don't know anyone. I don't know a single progressive or liberal that wants to redistribute. I don't know anyone who wants to go up and tell some billionaire, get out of your mansion, we're going to take it over. We want your yacht. We want your plane. I don't know anyone like that. Just the opposite. And the facts show it. Bill, like everything else, you got it backwards. Nobel laureate Joseph Stiglitz stated, the richest 1% of Americans now hold 25% of the country's wealth. The total income share of the 1% has jumped more in the United States than any other major Western country since 1960. And that's according to new research by Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Says. The top 1% share of the income dipped in some European countries and increased by up to 4 percentages elsewhere. But in a good USA, rich, 9% of the 9 percentage points richer. That's a big difference. So the next time you hear someone say, happy days are here again, the economy's flying again, the recession's over, the housing market's rebounding, it just looks so good. Well, I guess it does if you're looking in a mirror that someone's put some psychedelic glasses on and giving you some speed, I guess you're going to see everything a little differently. But for everyone else, for 240 million Americans, they don't see what you see. The reality is different. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us.
Oh, there's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what's wrong?
Welcome, all of you. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm told my guest is not available at this moment. We'll come back as soon as my guest is located. My guest today is Andrew Harvey, internationally renowned religious scholar and teacher. He is the founder of the Institute of the Sacred Activism, an international organization dedicated to inspiring people to become more involved in challenging our global crisis and to commit themselves to peace and sustainability. He studied at Oxford University and taught at Oxford, Cornell, and California Institute of Integral Studies. So he hopefully will be with us shortly. Going in, according to David Swanson, I was, quote, of mixed views regarding Sunday's rally in Washington, D.C. to save the Earth's climate from the tar sands pipeline. I still am. Why on a Sunday when there's no government around to protest, shut down, or interfere with? Why? And why all the pro-Obama rhetoric? Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was among the celebrities getting arrested at the White House in the days leading up, and his comment to the media was typical. Obama won't allow the tar sands pipeline, he said, because Obama has a strong moral core and doesn't really do, of course, evil things. As a belief, that's, of course, delusional. This is the same president who sorts through a list of men, women, and children to have executed every other Tuesday and who jokes about it. This is the guy who derailed international climate protection efforts for years. This is the guy who refused to demand to oppose the tar sands pipeline before last year's election. If he had been compelled to take a stand as a candidate, there'd be no need for this effort to bring him around as a lame duck. As a tactic, rather than a belief, the approach of the organizers of Sunday's rally is at least worth questioning. For one thing, people are going to hear such comments and take them for belief. People are going to believe that the president would never do anything really evil. In which case, why bother to turn out and rally in protest for what he's doing? Or if we do turn out, why communicate any serious threat of inconvenience to the president? On the contrary, why not make the protest into a campaign rally for the president, through which we try post-election to alter the platform on which the actual candidate campaigned? The advantage to the expect the best and the facts be damned approach is clear. Lots of people like it. You can't have a mass rally without lots of people. The organizers of this event are not primarily to blame for how the U.S. public thinks and behaves. But then again, if you're trying to maximize your crowd at all cost, hadn't you better really, truly maximize it? Sunday's rally probably suffered from being held on a bitterly cold day, but I suspect that most people who planned to come did come, and I've seen more people in a mall in the summer for no reason at all, and many more times in other occasions. What if the celebrities generating the news with arrests at the White House were to speak the truth? What if they committed to nonviolently interfering with the operations of a government destroying the climate? What if they committed to opposing the Democrat and Republican parties as long as this is their agenda? What if they said honestly and accurately that the personality of a president matters less than the pressures applied to him, that this president can do good and evil, and that it is our job to compel him to do good only? Sunday's rally, emceed by former anti-Republican war activist Lennox Yearwood, looked like an Obama rally. The protesters and banners displayed a modified Obama campaign logo, modified to read Forward on Climate. One of the speakers on stage, Van Jones, declared, "I had the honor of working for this president." He addressed his remarks to the president and appealed to his morality and supposed good works. "Mr. President, all the good that you have done will be wiped out if you allow the tar sands pipeline." The pretense in these speeches, including one by Senator Sheldon Whitehouse, was consistently that Obama had already approved part of the pipeline, that he is guilty of inaction, that the government is failing to act, that what is needed is action, as if our government were not actively promoting the use of and using vast quantities of fossil fuels, not to mention fighting wars and control of the fossil fuels. Van Jones ended his remarks by addressing himself to the next generation, and this is what he said: "Stop being chumps. You elected this president. You re-elected this president. You gave him the chance to make history. He needs to give you the chance to have a future. Stop being chumps. Stop being chumps and fight for the future. Thank you very much." Well, reading these words, one would imagine that the obvious meaning They carry us. Stop electing people like this who work for parties like this and serve financial interests like this. What could be more obviously the interpretation? You elect this guy twice. He's a lame duck now. You've lost your leverage. Stop being chumps. Nothing could be further, I think, from what Van Jones meant or what the crowd on Sunday believed he meant. This was a speaker who had just a moment before expressed his pride in having worked in Obama's White House. The fact that this crowd of Obama-branded activists had elected him twice was not mentioned in relation to their chumpiness, but as grounds for establishing their right to insist that he not destroy the planet's atmosphere. They would be chumps if they didn't hold more rallies like this one. Wait, you might ask, doesn't everyone have the right to insist that powerful governments not destroy the Earth's atmosphere? Well, maybe, but in Van Jones' thinking, those who committed to voting for Obama twice, no matter what he did, and who have committed to voting for any other Democrat, no matter what they would do, deserve particular attention when they make demands. Paradoxically, those who can be counted on regardless, who demand nothing and therefore offer nothing, should be the ones who especially get to make demands and have them heard and honored. Needless to say, it doesn't actually work that way. Our celebrity emperors attract a great deal of personal affection or hatred. So when I suggest an alternative to packaging a rally for the climate as a belated campaign event, it may be heard as a suggestion that no one's going to accept. Just remember, if you're proud to serve the man who was in the White House, Mr. Jones, are you proud to stand by as all the villages have been destroyed and the children dead? Are you proud to stand by as every single effort to bring our nation to a full awareness and a major campaign to stop using all the plastic and stop using non-recyclables and be against war and against violence? Are you for the incarceration and the export deportation of just illegal aliens trying to find work? Are you for putting people in jail for years for smoking or possessing marijuana? Are you for the criminalization of normal acts? Are you for establishing a psychiatry and allowing them to have the power to make even normal behavior a pathological condition? Are you for supporting clean coal? Are you for supporting offshore drilling and opening up our great national parks to mineral exploration? Are you for gas hydrofracking and nuclear power and expanding it? Are you for taking away the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and the habeas corpus? Are you for spying on Americans illegally? He is. So, which of those makes you a chump? I'm Gary Knoll. My guest is now on hold. Andrew Harvey, welcome to our program.
Gary, what an amazing piece you just delivered. Thank you. It's very fierce, and God knows that kind of fierce truth is very hard to speak in America.
Well, I just wish people would tell the truth and stop being political.
But I think people are absolutely terrified of the truth at the moment, which is that all of our agendas and parties and corporations are wholly bankrupt, and we've created a completely unsustainable way of life which is about to explode.
I think finding
ways to tell this truth is the name of the game, and to keep telling it because the lies ranged against it are now hysterical.
Well, that's why I wanted you to come on the air as a continuation of our conversations with Remarkable Minds. Your book, Radical Passions, Sacred Love and Wisdom in Action, your website, andrewharvey.net. Please share with us, and I want to give you just one primary question. Take it wherever you wish. Let's begin with a quote from your first book on sacred activism. You said, "When the joy of compassionate service is married to a practical and pragmatic drive to transform all existing economic, social, and political institutions, a radical and potentially all-transforming holy force is born." After reading that, the image of Gandhi comes to mind because he indeed recognized the imperative to transform all institutions that kept India bound to British colonialism. In many ways, the average American today is in a similar situation. However, we are not being colonized by a foreign power, but rather we are being colonized by mega corporations and banks too big to fail, and a federal system that protects executive and Wall Street interests. And as the history of Western colonization has shown, colonization imprisons the free expression of the soul of those colonized. So please take your time, expand on this idea and your quote, and define the connections between selfless service and radical activism, and how do we get to that point where we see our activism as a sacred duty?
It's a wonderful and very profound question. I think the place to start is with the nature of God itself, because if you can begin to have a really deep comprehension of that through the grace of the beloved and through the grace of the mystical systems, then you can come to begin to know what is happening and what is at stake. And I think the testimony of the great mystical traditions is that God is a unified force field, love, knowledge, bliss, energy, a divine light energy. And God is creating everything, living in and as everything. The entire reality is the manifestation of God. And that means that God is a marriage of opposites, a coincidentia oppositorum, a marriage of light and dark, the dark being as holy as the light, of matter and the light that engenders matter, and the matter being just as sacred and holy as the light. And that means that we are on the earth to embody the transcendent, to bring the truth and law and love and compassion and power and peace and great holy passion for reality of the transcendent down into our minds, down into our hearts, and into our bodies, so that we can become creative, humble agents of its divine will for the evolution of the planet in reality, in the real world. That is why we are here. And sacred activism is a word, a phrase, for this reality of being embodied love acting. Because it's only when you are embodied love acting that you unite with the full nature of the divine and the full nature of the divine field. Because the full nature of the divine is that it is both light and matter, light and dark, body and soul. It is the complete fusion of all opposites. And through becoming love embodied and acting from love, in the name of universal compassion and universal justice, and in the name of a great radical revolution of all the systems of the death machine, without doing that, without becoming a sacred activist, you cannot become fully alive, and you cannot seize the real meaning of this vast evolutionary crisis that we're in, which is that we are being compelled by the manufacture of our own massive hubris to either take a leap into embodied divine love and wisdom consciousness in action, or die out and take a great deal of the world with us. So this holy force is on the earth, and it's on the earth as a great gift of the motherhood of God, because it's the expression of the mother's great peace and her great passion for all her creation. And we've seen this holy force do absolutely amazing things in the 20th century. We've seen Gandhi take on the world's greatest empire and take it on non-violently with immense shrewdness and immense radicalism in terms of his own culture and immense courage in terms of just offering himself, his life, his whole life, everything he said and did as his fundamental message, giving himself up as a sacrifice for the future of the country and the world that he loved so much, and actually succeeding in doing that, despite enormous odds and despite the horror of what happened after partition, succeeding in seeding a vision of non-violent protest that could overturn terrifying powers. a vision that was taken up by Martin Luther King in America, and we saw this great, flawed, vulnerable, extremely complex man seize the day and represent for some searing, astounding, noble moments the full majesty of the Christ consciousness, calling for total transformation of the laws of America to protect and honor the black Americans who'd suffered so much, but also calling for forgiveness and reconciliation at the deepest level in the spirit of Jesus, and so able to mobilize the living conscience of many, many white people, who even non-Christians, because they saw in him someone who truly wanted a whole America, a healed America, an America in which black children and white children could grow up in true respect and true honor. And they saw that this was a holy mandate and a holy mission, and it had the power to avert what could have been terrible, terrible suffering and massacre and even worse division than there is in America now. And we saw this work in Solidarność, in Lech Walesa's heroic stand against the Russian Empire. We see this work in Aung San Suu Kyi. Look at this woman. She just stayed in house arrest for 17 years, refusing to sell her soul, radiating serenity, radiating equilibrium and wisdom, and radiating an universal compassion which included the very worst of the very terrible people ranged against her. And after 17 years of this, she emerged to be the spokesperson for the beginnings of a new democracy in Burma. So nobody can sit around and say that this force doesn't work. It does work. It works slowly. It works at the expense of immense personal sacrifice. The people who employ this force have to go through a transformation to be worthy of being its instruments. They have to be paid. They have to be wise, they have to be canny, they have to be deeply, deeply trained in reconciliation and forgiveness and universal compassion. They have to be wedded to the ideals and the living practice of the deepest kind of nonviolence, because if occasion ever arises for violence, and it may arise because we cannot write out anything, the only people that could ever, ever use the sword of violence would be those who would use it in the last resort and with the highest training in all other possible solutions. So we're really looking at a massive transformation of the human heart, the human mind, the human will, the human intention, in the face of a potentially all-threatening crisis, which if we rose to it in this way, fusing love of God, love of reality, passion for God, passion for reality, passion for the creation, passion for the animals, passion for each other, with a clear, focused, wise, canny approach to radical transformation of all existing institutions, economic systems, political systems, because it's quite clear that we've reached the end of the road and there is no way forward except through a massive, all-comprehensive revolution, grassroots revolution of love in action.
I really appreciate your insights. Many people describe the state of our world, nation, and planet in symbolisms that they are comfortable with and which infuses the crisis we face with meaning.
Yes.
Now, you've equated the state of the world today with what early Christians, St. John of Cross, called the dark night of the soul. And this state will either lead to our annihilation or to a true transformation. In other words, what mystics have defined as a certain stage in the spiritual growth of an individual are mirrored in the collective stages of society, nations, and the world as a whole. So first, explain the state of our nation and world today in this metaphysical sense of being a dark night. And then, in your estimation, how serious is the situation we find ourselves in?
I think when you awaken to the mystical nature of reality, it compels you to also accept the mystical nature of history, of our evolutionary history. And I think when you step back and see the steps of that evolutionary history, you see a race that began in a very matriarchal relationship with the world, unified with nature at very deep levels, sometimes terrified levels, sometimes superstitious levels, but very profound, illumined levels also, then took an enormous adventure into separation totally from nature, separating God from nature, separating the divine light from reality, and then plunging into a vast materialist scientific adventure which gave it enormous powers, but at the cost of tragic dissociation from the sacred, tragic dissociation from the mother, tragic dissociation from the unified force field of embodiment. And now we have created a crisis out of our hubris, out of our obsession with domination and power and exploitation of nature, out of our utter insane vanity about our own divine consciousness being so superior to the animals or to any other creature, out of this complete smorgasbord of outrageous, blasphemous, insane, power-drunk fantasies, we have created a suicidal and matricidal crisis. It's suicidal because we're destroying the very environment we live on, and we've created a death machine which we worship as the giver of life, when in fact it is absolutely destroying life. So we're in a state of dangerous psychosis. And this is the most dangerous, difficult, tragic, appalling situation that the human race has ever been in. And it's a situation that is not going to get better, because we're in the middle of an environmental freefall. The consensus of nearly all the major environmentalists that I know is that the environment is now beyond any kind of healing and control. We can do small things, and they're essential to do, and they're essential to do fast, because they give us just potential windows of dealing. But the fact is that we're in a great Kali event, a great destruction event. The great good news is that if you see reality mystically and step back and see this vast evolutionary drama as the drama of divine birth expressing itself through a huge dance of the opposites, then you see two things: that we almost certainly had to come to this moment when we had to make a major choice between power and death and love and humility and rebirth. It had to be part of the story, and it's the most dangerous part of the story. The second thing that you see is that the divine can use the most extreme horror and the most terrible dereliction and the most absolute destruction to galvanize wholly new aspects of itself in the human, to arouse and awaken wholly new reserves of passion and compassion and mutual cooperation and creativity. Evolution never works simply or easily. It works through convulsive crises. And we are in one of those, we're in the great convulsive crisis of our evolutionary history. If you see it from the mystical perspective as a global dark night, that is a tremendously grounding way of seeing it for two reasons. The first is that if you look at what the classic mystics describe as the dark night, you see that it involves what exactly is happening all over the world, a total and ruthlessly interconnected disintegration and deconstruction of all of the agendas, fantasies, and plans of the false collective self, i.e. of the whole American dream, capitalist dream, fantasy of power over nature. It is all going. All of the patriarchal fantasies of domination and all of the institutions are being revealed as nasty lies dedicated to death. We have to see this. And it's a help to know that that is part of the process, that masking, that demasking of the forces of deep destructiveness and their revelation as exactly as nasty as they truly are. The second thing that is very grounding about seeing this crisis as a global dark night is that the agony and heartbreak and even madness and sense of abandonment by the divine that you will feel when you start to register the depth of the crisis, the danger of the crisis, the extremity of the crisis, the challenge of the crisis, and the necessity of really going into a wholly new level of seriousness, both in your inner practice and your outer action that the crisis demands. When you really face that, you're going to feel terrible. It's not going to be fun. It's not going to be easy. It's a huge, terrible shock, and it is heartbreak after heartbreak, and you have to face the whole of the neglected shadow, your own terror, your own disillusion, your own dread, your own denial, your own collusion with all of the madness. And when you do, it is important to realize that that is also part of the dark night. That is what the mystics know, that it is essential for the ego to face its full, crazy, dark lunacy. And that's what the dark night makes possible, this totally humiliating shaming of yourself before the madness of the shadow of the world and your own shadow and the collusion between the two. This is natural. This is not you going mad. This is what is required for going sane. And that is what the classic teachings tell us, and that's why they're so extremely important. The great evolutionary mystics in the last 150 years have added something that is very thrilling to the mix, and I think that that's what I believe and I am seeing more and more clearly. It is that what is at stake now is whether or not the birth that our whole evolutionary history was meant to culminate in and to begin a wholly new set of evolutions, the birth of a conscious divine intelligence embodied here in us on Earth in loving, creative, just action. Whether this great birth can take place now, the opportunity is here, the great dismantling is here, the great destruction is here. But what we need to be is to be here with this great evolutionary love force that has a will of its own, an intelligence of its own, a demand of its own, a ruthlessness of its own, and will guide us if we're prepared to really give up our fantasy of knowledge and control through what is going to be a vast evolutionary hurricane. So that's what I think, and that's what I experience. And my actual experience is that if you do consent to be guided through the hurricane by this love force, enormous joy will come to you, and a great sense of focus, and a deep, deep sense of the holiness and sanctity of the whole creation, and a much more radical depth of embodiment will be made available to you. And that will be worth whatever you have to pay, in whatever circumstances you have to pay it, because you will know humbly and very down homely that you are living as far as you can with all your flaws and follies, a taste of the divine life on Earth right now in a body.
I just have two additional questions, and if I could have a little short answer.
Yes,
I want to get them both in.
You opened a huge can of golden worms there. I hope it was an answer you could relate to.
It was not just an answer. It was an inspirational moment. It was cathartic. So I appreciate what you shared with us.
It's important to realize that we have an analysis for this collapse. We are not bereft of a real map. It's not a flattering map, but it's a real map.
Okay. One of the emotions that is easily evoked in activists when we look at our government today and corporate America today and even our own inertia and hubris today is anger.
Yes.
For the truly progressive voices in the country like Chris Hedges and Margaret Wright and Tom Engelhardt.
Oh, God, Chris Hedges, so wonderful.
Yeah. Naomi Klein and Cornel West and David Swanson, Paul Craig Robbins, so many others.
Yes.
There's a noticeable anger that fuels their opposition to the status quo. So please speak about the role of anger in activism and its role in speaking truth to power. And how can this emotion be harnessed and used positively to serve the kind of inspiration necessary for people to be catalysts for positive change?
Well, I think it's a process, and I would love to say that I think Chris Hedges, for example, is an absolutely amazing voice, and I deeply appreciate his divine ferocity. I don't think it's just a personal, neurotic, self-absorbed, self-righteous anger. I think Chris Hedges is genuinely possessed by sacred outrage, and that I think his analyses and his denunciations have a tremendous force of truth because they're born from this impersonal Black Madonna Kali fury at what we are doing. So I'd like to say that because I think the people that you're quoting are fueled by anger, but a great deal of the anger that they are fueled by is related in a very profound way to the divine ferocity of the mother force of God that is absolutely furious at the way in which we are behaving. And this fury is the Kali aspect of the dark feminine, and the anger of these people is connected to that. Now, the problem becomes this. How can we get in touch with this Kali fury, this agony of outrage at the violence and cruelty and injustice and madness of a system that is killing us and killing everything? How can we begin to get in touch with that force and not be overmastered by it, paralyzed by it, destroyed by it, maddened? Because you don't approach that force except with immense awe and immense respect. So we need to dive into the great tantric traditions to get the clue. And I was taught an amazing exercise by a great old woman tantric in Benares who said, look, you do not wish to waste the golden fuel of anger, because when you find that golden fuel, you find sacred passion and energy, and you can wed that with your wisdom to really fuel your work in the world, and it will give you tremendous power and tremendous energy. But what you need to do is to give up your anger, to give up your rage to Kali, who is the great queen of rage, and have her transmute that complex, dark, golden mass of your rage into pure golden passion energy, a tremendous, focused, laser-like, adamantine energy that can tell total truth to power in such a way that power knows not only that its mask is stripped from it, but also that it is love that is speaking, not judgment only, but a massive opportunity for the transformation even of the powerful, even of those who have done the great crimes that are now falling upon us. And this is a new force. This is the force, the Jesus force, the Christ force, the love consciousness force. So what you need to do is a process. You need to absolutely get in touch with the outrage that you must have as a human being in front of all of this craziness. And you need to realize that you've been domesticated and castrated and tamed and had your sacred emotions deeply, deeply humiliated by a Stepford kind of New Age spirituality which denies the divine force of the sacred emotions. You need to realize that that's part of the great massacre of the feminine that has massacred men and women. We've been turned into neutered, spiritually correct, Stepford, smiling, material manifestors when we should be loving wild servants of the beloved. So getting in touch with your sacred outrage is going to be a brutal process, because you're going to have to tear off the kind of layers in your heart that have shut down in the face of this chaos. But then you're also going to have to face the problem of the power that's in that outrage, the great power of destructiveness and of self-righteousness. You're going to have to face the shadow of that. And then you're going to have to offer it to the great queen of destruction and creation, the great Black Madonna, the great Kali, and say, take this and transmute it. Don't tame it. Don't tamp it down. Don't make me a neutered, sweet, smiling conspirator in the great concentration camp. Don't make me that. But don't make me so crazy and so denunciatory and so ridden by my own unhealed shadow that I cannot be the vehicle of absolutely divine, fierce love in action. That's right. The tantric transformation. And that's what all sacred activists are truly called to, because nothing less will work.
I just one quick answer, because we're running late.
Yes.
What would you say to those who claim to be very spiritual but see no reason to become politically or environmentally active? It causes to save our world, because they believe opposition to Obama or our political system or Wall Street is too negative. What are your thoughts about this type of spirituality that refuses to recognize there is evil in the world? It reminds me of something Matthew Fox wrote in an earlier book. He was my guest yesterday, and I'll just paraphrase his thoughts.
Yes.
The new commandment should not be to forgive us because we don't know what we do, but rather forgive us because we don't know we know we should be doing. And
that's
in
it.
This sense, I believe that so much spirituality today is a victim of this sin of non-doing, non-acting, passively watching. Your final short comments.
Well, I think the spirituality you describe is not a spirituality at all. It's a corporate-sponsored drug that's given to millions of people to keep them absolutely passive, paralyzed, comatose, individually self-obsessed and narcissistic. And it cannot face the spirituality anything. It can't face the suffering of the planet. It can't face the suffering of the path. It can't face the necessity of sacrifice. It can't face the absolute centrality of service to any kind of decent spiritual path. And it certainly can't face anything about this vast crisis and the necessity for a total transformation of everything that it's calling out. So it's completely and absolutely and finally bankrupt. And it's part of the depths of the problem, because it has polluted this fake mysticism, this fake spirituality, hundreds of millions of minds and souls at this moment, when only the real wine of authentic, rugged, transformative truth has a hope in heaven or hell of being of any use.
Andrew, could I invite you back to talk about the Occupy movement and what I saw was its lack of spirituality, and also this whole faux spirituality that's over Sedona and all these other places where they talk about mysticism, but they don't do a single thing.
Oh, God, I will talk to you at any time of the day or night about these things. This is the great plague of our time. It's a leprosy of the soul.
Then it
should be talked about.
Then you will be invited back shortly. Andrew Harvey, thank you for being on today.
My great pleasure, Gary. Thank you for your work.
Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Andrew Harvey, the author of Radical Passion. AndrewHarvey.net. I'm Gary Nall. Sorry for going a little late today. Have a nice day, everyone. Now let's say hello to Utrice Leeds. Sorry, Utrice, we ran into your show here, but
up from where we left off yesterday. There were so many calls that we decided we would just extend it. We were flooded with calls yesterday and couldn't have the time to take them all, so we'll do that today.
Great. Thank you, and we look forward to listening to your show. Utrice Leeds coming in a moment. Please stay with us.